Welcome to the Depicting the Invisible podcast. I am Susan J. Barron. I'm a contemporary artist, and my body of work depicting the invisible is a portrait series of veterans suffering from PTSD. This work is in direct response to the 22 veterans who commit suicide every day in this country. This portrait series is currently on exhibition at the Hunter Museum of American Art and the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. In each podcast, we focus on one of the works from the Depicting the Invisible portrait series and do a deeper dive into the issues raised in these veteran stories. Now, one of the things that I find really interesting about doing a podcast about art is visualizing the work for the listening audience. However, there is a link to see all the art discussed today where you signed into the podcast. Today, we're going to start with a portrait of Private Ken Weinert. But first, I would like to introduce my guest. Josh Mance is a motivational speaker and process philosopher focused on trauma, consciousness, and near-death experiences. Ken's portrait deals with his near-death experience, and I think Josh is the perfect guest to respond to this work. Josh served as an infantry officer in the United States Army for nearly 10 years. He is a recipient of the Purple Heart, Bronze Star with Valor, and Combat Infantryman's Badge. In other words, a true American hero. Our paths crossed because he is one of the 25 veterans whose combat experience is showcased in the National Veterans Memorial and Museum, where my show, Depicting the Invisible, is currently on exhibition. Welcome, Josh.
Hey, thanks so much, Susan. It's great to be here with you.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. So, Josh, I know that you just had the opportunity to see the Depicting the Invisible exhibition at the National Veterans Memorial and Museum. So at the risk of making myself extremely vulnerable, I would really like your honest reaction to the portrait series.
It was extremely powerful, Susan. I'm not just saying that because I'm on here. That's part of the reason why we got connected is when the director of the museum took me through it. I was really impressed by the degree of expression that all of those portraits portray, for lack of a better word. And I think it really does bring out a lot of deeper characteristics that can't necessarily be captured in words or are very difficult to.
Yeah, thank you. That's very kind of you. So one of the portraits that you saw there was the portrait of Ken, and I'd like to start with that. And first I'm going to describe it for the audience, and then we can discuss. So the work is a 72-inch by 72-inch mixed-media work on canvas. It's composed of photographic imagery, paint, collage, and text. The black-and-white photographic imagery is tremendously detailed, and you can see every pore and each whisker. The style is classically lit and elegant, in direct contrast to the extreme brutality of his story, which is graffitied over his portrait. The background is painted in a black-on-black abstracted camouflage pattern, removing any time or place context and alluding to a dark military experience. There are collaged elements of actual combat photography floating around the portrait, representing the memories that Ken cannot escape, the images that he describes as circling in his mind. Facing us is the back of the black metal frame of the chair that Ken is sitting on. He leans towards us, his right arm draped in front of him over the back of the chair. We see the tattoo on his upper arm, and we see a big scar running through it. He shows us this proudly. He makes direct eye contact with the viewer. His expression is at the same time matter-of-fact and yet deeply emotional. You can't look away. His thoughts surround him. Some of the graffiti is painted in silver, so as the viewer walks past the portrait, the metallic quality of the words make them appear to float forward and recede, depending on the lighting. This is Ken's story in his own words. Quote, June 18, 2004 is my alive day. I was the gunner in the Humvee. They hit my right arm. It was severed. I think I lost my right arm, I screamed to my sergeant. He turns around. His face was hanging halfway off, his eyes hanging out of his head. Your arm is on top of the Humvee, somebody shouts. There's blood everywhere. I pull my arm down. They let me call my mom. She worked at Walmart. She always had her phone with her in case I called. I said, Mom, I'm severely hurt and they don't know whether I'll live or die. I don't celebrate my birthday anymore. I only celebrate my alive day. I also share that day with two battle buddies. I look at my alive day as a second chance on life, a new start to be the best man I can be. I'm diagnosed with PTSD. I lost 2/3 of my benefits because I can now move my arm 45 degrees. I can't hold a knife or a fork. I can't tie my shoes, but I'm a better person now. Every year on my alive day, I get to reflect on how lucky I am. So Josh, I wonder if you would share your response to Ken's story, just on a personal level.
Yes, very, very powerful description of the photo and just in his own words as well. The thing that immediately hit me during that was when he made the call to his mother. That is something that I more or less directly experienced in my injury, which I know we'll get into in a bit, but I actually died for 15 minutes, just to give your listeners context, after being shot by a sniper. And it was the lead up to that experience of actually dying and crossing that horizon where the very last thoughts, that conscious thoughts that really ran through my head, were of my family and repeating the names of my mother and my two sisters over and over again for the last 60 seconds of my life or so. And kind of as I was making the transition into death, the only thing that I could do in that moment was to just ask, please take care of them, under my breath. And in a lot of ways, that may have been my first real prayer. So there's a lot to that that could be explained further and in a different context. But what I'd like to draw out is just the power of love. And when things really come down to it, what are really the last things that cross through your mind? What are really the things that are perhaps most important to us are revealed in these moments of extreme adversity or death?
Well, I think that we should back up a little bit. And, you know, I know that you were shot by an enemy sniper in Iraq. Why don't you tell us that story?
Sure. This was April 2007 in northeastern Baghdad. And we were actually conducting a humanitarian patrol that day, which went well, but we got moved to another part of the sector. And as we were searching a suspicious vehicle who we had thought just conducted an attack, we were engaged by a sniper. That bullet entered the left arm of my senior non-commissioned officer, Staff Sergeant Marlon Harper. It severed his aorta and then ricocheted into my upper right thigh and severed my femoral artery. So for the next 30 minutes or so, it was really a, you know, there's a lot of details that I could get into that we could talk about for probably hours, even sequentially, but in terms of what that was like. But after a lot of heroic actions from my team members, that kind of inspired me to keep going. I lasted for about 30 minutes or so and actually flatlined on the table of that medical team where I died for a full 15 minutes.
So I think that a lot of people would be really curious to know what happened during that time. Were you consciously knowing that you were dying? Were the classic typical things that you hear people report, like seeing a white light or seeing an aerial view of the hospital room where you were? Did you have any of those types of experiences? What were you feeling and what were you thinking?
So there's a pretty complex answer to that, depending on how deep we want to go. But, you know, and kind of what I'm studying professionally in metaphysics and consciousness and our perception as we're going through situations like this of extremely high intensity, specifically trauma. So, for example, there was an evolution. There were different forms of altered states of consciousness that I experienced throughout this 30-minute period or so from the time that I was shot to the time that I died. And what I mean by an altered state of consciousness is, you know, a common example, very, very common example would be peak experiences throughout our lives. Medication or drugs can alter our states of consciousness in a different way. The autonomic response, which is our body's physiological response to threat, like the startle response, fight, flight, or freeze, that can also be an altered state of consciousness, meaning that it's radically different from what we experience in day-to-day life as our baseline. So when I first got hit by the sniper, this was an immediate life-threatening situation, and the body responded accordingly. I experienced slow motion time, fast motion time, auditory distortion, kind of a superhuman strength. I drug Marlon out of the way and started to perform aid on him with a blown out femoral artery, and he felt like a feather. And that wasn't a conscious choice. That was a subconscious urge to do that. So there is this very prolonged autonomic response, this fight, flight, and freeze response, where I actually experienced all three of those in rapid succession in the first 15 seconds or so. Shortly after that, I collapsed. I was working on Marlon and my medic arrived, who, by the way, was only 19 years old, and suddenly had a conscious choice to make between who he was going to save and who was going to die, which is something called an irresolvable moral dilemma. It's a major source of trauma where there's no positive outcome to be had. When he arrived, I think I almost sensed a sense of safety that came with him. And my body just collapsed to the ground and kind of went into what I think was approaching death at that moment. And that was a different altered state of consciousness. It was a very different experience from that first phase, kind of like being in a daze, just very comfortable, getting ready to go to sleep. It was peaceful, actually.
Did you experience pain?
No physical pain. The anaerobic pain kicked in later when I was at the medical aid station. The body, the bizarre thing about this is that the body was in complete shock, but my mind was crystal clear, to the point where when I was in the aid station, I could recall in detail who was standing around the table, you know, while I was still conscious. But I had like a very strong memory of everything that was happening and going on.
Yeah. You know, there's a point where you recalled when the medical team that was working on you thought you were unconscious, but you could recall everything that they were saying. What do you learn about consciousness?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I was conscious when I was in that medical room, not unconscious. The experience of death itself was a couple minutes later, as I made that transition, was without question the most powerful experience of my life. It was overwhelmingly peaceful, joyous. It was death as an acceleration.
Explain that.
Meaning that so to preface this, you know, we're talking kind of broadly here, but what I'm about to say, like, my intention isn't to offend anyone's spiritual beliefs. So if that's an issue, just know that this is coming. Like, this is just literally my direct experience. Many of the things that a lot of people who experience near-death experiences have, which is these feelings of interconnectedness and oneness and becoming one with everything and nothing, becoming one with the supreme good or supreme truth or God. And in becoming one with God, and this is kind of the part that they can maybe elicit a little bit of fear from people, even though that's not the intention, right, is that in becoming one with God, there is a sacrifice of the self. And it is most welcome, because it's the most exhilarating and unfathomable feeling that we can experience. And the price of it is death. It felt as though every kind of morsel of my, I call it an atomization of the soul, or almost if the soul was composed of photons or some particle that, in death, it was as if I could feel every one of those particles vibrating and accelerating out of my body and going home.
Wow.
Just immediately after saying goodbye to my family. You know, we often have these fears and think of death. Of our biggest fear maybe is leaving people behind and loss and grief. One of the parts that I've been trying to reconcile over the last 15 years and in studying this stuff is, what does it mean if during that transition into death, where we become so overwhelmingly joyous that all the other stuff fades away, everything that we perceived as good or bad fades away, and it yields to this supreme good, this feeling. So that's one aspect of it, right?
That's amazing.
The other aspect is, what happens when we come back?
Before you get to that, I just want to put into perspective. Tell me the odds of reviving someone who's flatlined for 12, 13, or 14 minutes like you had.
Very low, very low. So there's this thing today with modern medicine kind of called the golden hour, which they've can pull people back. Like it's very, very rare, but they've pulled people back who have flatlined as much longer than 15 minutes. But the typical standard for when most physicians will call it on a patient is around the 6 minute mark of no breathing, no pulse, because that's when catastrophic brain damage tends to set in. So the real miracle of this is maybe not necessarily pulling me back. It is pulling me back and me not having a trace of brain damage and full recollection of the experience.
Wow. Well, thank goodness. When your surgical team was trying to get a pulse, you were told this story, I think years later, your scouts were waiting outside the medical tent and they finally got a pulse.
And yeah. This story always kind of gives me chills. And this is the one of this whole experience. This is the story that's captured in the museum. You know, yeah, so I flatline and I didn't know what was going on. Obviously, I was unconscious, but the medical team pulls off this miracle and gets a faint pulse back. And just to give you an idea of how, to the extent that this team went to pull that off, you know, this was an American treatment facility in, you know, a very small rudimentary base in the middle of, you know, northeastern Baghdad. So they had an exceptional medical team, but, you know, kind of just the basic equipment. And when I actually got in there, I was told later that the defibrillator paddles that they used to shock me back to life literally arrived at the base that very morning, and they had to take them out of the plastic to use them on me. And I also learned that they basically were working on me on top of a cot, and there was a mechanical failure of the cot, which prevented them from lowering it to the proper height to do CPR. And it just so happened that there was this former football lineman who was now a private first class, who probably weighed a good 260, 270 pounds and 6'6", who was the only person who stood there and did live CPR on me for 15 minutes straight, which for listeners who don't have a perspective on that, this is an extremely exhausting physical activity. Like most people will be tired, like exhausted and breathing heavy after two or three minutes. And so he was just pouring sweat the whole time, and he was doing it standing on top of a crate.
Wow.
Nonetheless, they didn't quit, didn't give up. They kept going, and they worked as a very powerful, cohesive team with a unified purpose. And when they got that faint pulse back, they had a Black Hawk helicopter running hot on the green zone, ready to take me to more advanced care, surgery in the green zone. And as they were rushing me out, they encountered my scout platoon, who had been waiting on the outcome, worried. They had already learned that Marlon died. But as that medical team was rushing out, they stopped the medical team in their tracks and said, "No, he's our lieutenant. We're putting him on that bird."
I love that.
Right.
I love that story. I mean, how did that make you feel when you heard that?
Well, a tremendous amount of just gratitude, pride, humility, connection, and, you know, care, and just sort of this bond of a team that was, I think, expressed in that situation. This in the same breath is also something I'll point to in a larger context when it comes to trauma and the things that can begin to heal trauma, is a lot of these little brief moments and stories like this will get overshadowed by negativity as we continue to live our lives. So part of the process of healing and trauma is being able to tell our story in a way that captures its true essence. And sometimes investigating these experiences and going back into them, as difficult as it can be, can reveal moments like this that can start to balance out all of the negativity that are embedded within these experiences.
Yeah.
And for the scouts, this is a moment of agency. This is them taking control back, even in a small way, of a situation that was stolen from them by an enemy sniper just a few minutes prior.
Yeah. So after that experience, I have to ask you, were you surprised to wake up 2 days later in the green zone and realize that you weren't dead after all?
No, I don't know that surprise would be the word that I used. I was kind of right back in it. When I realized what happened, the first question that I had was of Marlon Harper and if he made it or not, which I kind of had a sense that he didn't. So I wasn't surprised about that, but it was a confirmation. And from that point forward, it was full bore into the medical evacuation process and healing. So I had the opportunity, by the way, to call my mom during that process. And that's when I learned that she actually got the call that her son was not going to make it, that the condition was stale and stagnant. And they were actually rushing to get on a plane to Germany to come meet me to see if they could be with me before I died. That's what my mom actually felt and was feeling as this is happening. I woke up much earlier and snapped back from this much earlier. So by that night I was calling her and kind of starting to make it a little bit humorous, however I could. So
I can't imagine being your mother in that position. That must have been just totally dreadful.
Well, anytime we're experiencing trauma, it's not just on the individual, it's on the network of relationships that surround them. So although I didn't realize this for years later, because, you know, I was just, there was a lot going on and in the aftermath of this, but it was years later that I would come to realize the impact that this had on my family as well in their particular way.
Yeah. So I want to circle back to an important part of the story that you hit on and talk about the moral weight of decisions that are made in a nanosecond and talk about this concept of moral injury. So there was a young medic that made that conscious choice who to save that day that you were shot, and Sergeant Marlon Harper died based on his decision. And you've said that these decisions plant the seeds for moral, ethical, and spiritual turmoil. So can you talk about the weight of that decision on that teenager and the concept of moral injury?
Yeah, so moral trauma is a form of trauma that I think is probably the most significant form of trauma, as is grief and loss. Moral trauma is experiencing something that somehow violates or destroys my pre-existing beliefs about the world, other people, or myself. So when we talk about the context of moral trauma, we're talking about emotions, powerful emotions like shame, guilt, powerlessness, betrayal, disgust, anger. Moral trauma can be directed at ourselves. I feel that I should have done something to prevent a negative outcome from occurring, or it can be directed at other people or organizations, such as I'm angry that they should have done something to prevent the negative outcome from occurring. The example of the medic is just an example of a situation that can lead to moral trauma, not necessarily always. But here's a case where we have a choice that we have to make. Two people in front of me, both have less than 2 minutes to live. I cannot save both of them. So I have to make a choice between who's going to live and who's going to die, or at least who I'm going to attempt to save. The medic in this case, objectively, very much made the right choice in trying to save me because my injury was slightly less severe than Marlon's and I had a slightly better chance of survival. So in terms of his training and triage and all of these other factors and variables, like, he couldn't have done it better that day. But the moral dimension of this is can run very deep in terms of why was I put in a position to make this terrible choice to begin with? And what does that mean that I had to save this person as opposed to that person? Or did it opens up the door to many different moral and spiritual types of concerns. These are the types of things that can create the conditions for shame and guilt and betrayal that kind of can stay with us for a very long time if they're not understood, integrated into our lives and resolved.
Yeah. You know, I've been working on depicting the invisible since 2018. And I've only recently started hearing this concept of moral injury. And I think that it just resonates with me so much that it's this aspect of PTSD that I haven't really heard identified before. It's not just the trauma of war, but it's the conflict, the internal conflict of doing things that you know aren't right, or all these other moral kinds of conflicts. The concept of moral injury really needs to be explored more and brought into the conversations around PTSD, because I think it could be something that could be really helpful. So in true superhero fashion, you are already planning your redeployment to Iraq during the trip to Walter Reed, where you were sent to recover from your near-death experience in Iraq. Now, most people would not, I can't imagine that being your mindset. It's like you were already thinking that you should be back there with your men, and you were feeling guilty for not being where you knew you belonged, even though you had just died. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's. I know that can sound difficult for some people to comprehend. But I would say that most people, I think, if depending on the situation that they were in and the bond with the team that they have, especially in the context of professions like our military, that attitude of and commitment of wanting to get back and serve with your team, there's few things that overcome that or that can outweigh that. Every minute on that plane ride home was really a minute farther away from my team. It wasn't a minute closer to home. There's something about not being able to be with people you love when they're in harm's way that is profoundly difficult to deal with. And it can generate a lot of tension and suffering and conflict. In the hospital, in Walter Reed, I would say the positive reasons for me going back were that, yes, I wanted to get back to my team. I was still the leader of that team, despite my injuries, and I had a responsibility to lead them. So if there's any possibility of getting back, I felt that it was a responsibility to do so. The second reason is kind of more personal. There was a hesitation within me, maybe even a call it a fear of an unknown, which is I needed to prove to myself that I could continue to do my job. I can think back in a safe hospital bed that I can go back and perform in combat again. But after something like that, there is just a tinge of humility there that I didn't really know until I got back and put it to the test. The third reason, which was a surprise when I got there, that kind of validated that it was important to go back and kind of these positive reasons. One, I got to meet the medical team that saved my life, which was one of the best days of my life.
Describe that.
This conversation ties right into moral trauma. But as we talk about this medical team that saved my life, that's when I really learned the details of the story that we were talking about earlier. It's from them directly. And, you know, typically what happens with an emergency medical team is they receive somebody who's in critical condition, life-threatening condition. They pull off miracles sometimes in order to stabilize that person, pull them back. And then as soon as they do, they're kicking them off to the next echelon of care. They never get to see the results of their work, or rarely. And what I noticed immediately was they had no expectation that I would be back. In fact, the brigade surgeon was a little angry with me for coming back. And then he gave me a big hug, rightly so. But they had my medical records hanging on their wall because they were so proud of what they accomplished that day. And that medical team treated over 350 trauma cases just like mine in the span of a 1-year deployment. And most of them they lost. So there's a lot of loss of these medical teams before they get to cherish. And maybe what is this diamond in the rough, this miracle, this incredible effort that really demonstrates all of the work that they put into this. But there's an analogy to that this idea of cumulative trauma, of seeing death over and over and over again, and all these horrific injuries over and over and over again, is a function of cumulative trauma. You know, one traumatic incident can impact us for the rest of our lives. So too can many, many, many different small ones that continue to add up. Mm-hmm. And we see this today throughout the pandemic. The number of doctors who had to make decisions on who to give a ventilator if there was only one and not enough people could get them. That is the moral dimension of trauma.
Yeah.
And loss. So the other positive part of going back was seeing my team. It's difficult for me to describe what that was like seeing them. That also was kept as a surprise. And I think really just from an objective standpoint, I think that whole experience just really helped lift their spirits up and mine at a time when they were at a really rough spot in that deployment.
That's amazing. You know, I want to just circle back to Ken for a minute. I want to tell you a small little story that's not that different from your experience with going back and seeing your doctors, except this was completely unexpected. So Depicting the Invisible was on exhibition in Manhattan. And many of the veterans who were in the portrait series were there. And there were many other veterans groups that had come. So there were a lot of veterans there. And Ken was standing in front of his portrait, and a guy comes over to him, an older gentleman, and he's reading the portrait, and he's looking at the dates, and he's reading the portrait, and he was this head surgeon in that area during that surgery. He performed that surgery. He performed that surgery on Ken. And he's like, let me see your arm. Let me see your arm. I recognize that. They had never met post his surgery. And to see Ken doing so well and to meet the surgeon who operated on him out of the blue, it was the most amazing emotional reunion. And just to be there to witness that was really incredible. They were hugging. It was really pretty incredible.
That's fantastic when people get that opportunity, right? It is because now the story is a little bit more complete. And in both of their lives. And now there's a slightly different meaning. There's a different meaning for that surgeon, and there's maybe a slightly different meaning for Ken that we've now kind of entered into that chapter of healing. So I think that's a really powerful thing to bring out there.
Yeah. We digressed a little, and you were talking about that guilt that you were experiencing at Walter Reed. So I just want to bring you back to that.
Yeah. So this is just another way to help people kind of, if you haven't heard this term moral trauma before, or kind of what is it, this is another form of that. And this is what I would call maybe the negative reasons that were luring me back to Baghdad. The things that were happening subconsciously back then that I wasn't aware of was this very powerful sense of guilt. What I mean by that is not just in being away from my team, but And look, the care that I got at Walter Reed Army Medical Center was exceptional every step of the way. This isn't to take anything away from that whatsoever. But regardless of that, Walter Reed is a very difficult place to be emotionally because you're surrounded by all of the worst service members coming back from Baghdad and the other in Afghanistan at that time, right? All these severe injuries and you're seeing the impacts that has on their families. And frankly, I was one of the only ones in the hospital. Sorry, go ahead.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but I just wonder if you could share some of the, like maybe the people that you met there and what you saw.
Yeah. I mean, the image that really comes to mind that kind of describes this is just seeing a very young woman, probably in her early 20s, pushing around her new double amputee fiance in a wheelchair. I was on crutches. I walked around a corner and I saw this and I just stopped because I realized like, here's this young love together that now has this profound change and went through this profound trauma. It was really difficult to be around that, especially when I knew I was one of the only ones in the hospital expected to make a full recovery. As bad as my injury was, I got very fortunate in terms of the type of damage that it did. So there and again, it's like, I think there was part of that guilt, that shame that I was feeling was causing me to run away from Walter Reed.
Well, there's this moment in your book where you describe pulling the staples out of your leg with a Letterman tool right before your medical evaluation to get cleared to redeploy. There, that was an expression of urgency to get out of there.
I forgot about that. Yeah, I haven't read my book since I published it 4 years ago. I forgot about that story. Once I kind of got through it, yeah, there was really a sense of urgency. I mean, yeah, I was accelerating my healing process by pulling staples out of my leg. And there was a certain point in time where I just had this kind of an unbreakable will and urge to go back. And if there was any possibility of doing that, like I was going to find it. So yeah, I went back to start to redeploy, and there was all these barriers and medical restrictions that they weren't going to let me. So I kind of had to maneuver around some of those obstacles in various ways, but ultimately ended up getting back with my team 4 or 5 months later.
So you talk about that once you are on your redeployment, that your responses weren't exactly what you expected, and that you started sort of suppressing and compartmentalizing things, as you said, like a champ. I've heard a lot of veterans talk about that that's what they do. And I wonder if you can describe what that's like.
Yeah. So more broadly, to kind of lead into that, a lot of the things that we experience when we talk about trauma, it's not necessarily the traumatic incident itself that is the problem. That might be the source. It is the deterioration that occurs afterwards. We tend to get wrapped around the actual event itself, like getting shot or being assaulted or being in an accident. And that can certainly be the source of a lot of things. But when we're talking about the weight of moral trauma over time or grief and loss over time, right, those things, when they're not integrated and understood, can really start to contort our soul, right? It can start to contort our sense of self and the way we feel about the world over time, right? So this idea of suppressing is one of the common characteristics of being exposed to chronically traumatic environments is emotional withdrawal. And this numbness, this deep sense of depression, not being able to feel anything, not being able to feel alive. And it's this lack of feeling alive that often causes us or leads to us taking kind of higher risk behaviors or things that are related to various forms of addiction that can sort of maybe not be healthy, but can reinvigorate that sense of feeling alive temporarily. Kind of one of the things that can lead to that is a very natural thing that occurs in places like combat is soldiers and service members learn how to suppress their emotions at a championship level. And one of the most powerful emotions we can learn to suppress is fear and terror. If I cower down to fear and terror as a service member in combat, I'm not going to be a very effective soldier. So a lot of the virtues and values that our military breeds is designed to be able to perform in the face of fear. So when we're in life-threatening situations over and over again, and those surges of emotions continue to hit us, more and more we start to learn how to make that surge of emotion less and less so that we become better at what we do. So this idea of suppressing emotions, it's not necessarily a negative thing. It is what allows us to not only survive, but to thrive and excel in these types of environments. The problem with it is when we come back, yeah, and reintegrate with our families and our social networks and our world before the deployment, because that emotional withdrawal then can become something that is a block to intimacy with a partner, with loved ones in various ways. And that is one of the biggest indications of trauma in the way that we're discussing it, right? It is the fallout of trauma, if you will. Right. It's maybe in that feeling of numbness where we once felt love.
Yeah. That's, I think that's,
it can be recovered. It can be overcome through work, though. I want to leave people with a sense of hope.
Yeah, that's really important. You know, I want to come back to, Ken and his portrait and how he's talking about, you know, that when he had a near death experience, he really sought to find meaning in a second life. And I know that you also went through that same journey. I would love to hear about that. And I'd also like to know how you grapple with the second life question of what was I brought back to do?
So the second life for me, I actually did not share with Ken right away this gratitude for being alive.
Really?
No, I didn't. And I actually didn't even realize that until close to, I would say, 12, 13 years later. And, you know, in having a conversation with some other service members who experienced similar things, I found myself kind of isolated in terms of a lot of people did feel this gratitude to be alive. And I suddenly realized that I had never genuinely felt that. To me, it felt like there was some responsibility, there was some obligation, there was some purpose with which I had to fulfill in order to, I didn't know where that was coming from, but I felt it. And it's driven me ever since. Ultimately, I think that the quest for life is really a quest for meaning. The meaning of those experiences was revealed progressively over the next 15 years with a lot of contemplation and a lot of work, a lot of mishaps and a lot of falls, a lot of losing myself and regaining it again. But ultimately, so here's the thing. Trauma, even though we perceive it as negative, and adversity, you know, toxic adversity, which we generally perceive as negative, if we survive it, I do believe that trauma can accelerate our journey towards truth when we know how to look at it through more productive lenses other than the negative ones. Yeah. The reason for that is trauma is a form of experience that is a very high intensity experience, and intensity brings with it contrast with what we previously knew. And it's kind of within the gaps of what we previously knew and what we know now, where these different forms of truth about the world can emerge that we need to evaluate, understand, and integrate moving forward. The other thing is, sometimes in the aftermath of trauma, something that I think is neglected or forgotten about, especially in moral trauma, you know, moral trauma is the compromise or destruction of our values. It's a hit on the way we believe the world should work, or in comparison to how we believed it innocently operated before. And it's this form of moral trauma that can continue to stick with us and kind of degrade our capacity to make meaning out of these things. So as we investigate back into these experiences, though, sometimes we can find virtues and values that were important to us then that we can make a conscious choice to live by now. It's all about the narrative we tell, the story we tell. I'm not talking about turning trauma into rainbows. That's not the case. What I do mean is kind of in the sense that I see in your exhibit too, there's a lot of beauty in it, but there was also a lot of darkness in it. And we can't have one without the other to portray the essence of what this really is. We can choose beauty once we understand both dimensions, right? Or kind of both extremes. But we have to be willing to lean into that darkness, bring it to the surface in order to examine it, understand it, integrate it, determine what our values and virtues are from it. And then we can make a conscious choice to live by them moving forward.
In your book, you talk about the Died and Came Back to Life Club. And I just wanted to know, do you think that group sees the world differently?
Well, I think each experience is individual. However, there are some common threads between people who have experienced near death. A lot of the themes that I have experienced during death match up with those, in terms of, you know, a lot of people say that they no longer have a fear of death. They feel a sense of interconnectedness. They feel a greater sense of gratitude and love and a variety of other things. So yes, I do think that it is a type of experience that, in the end, for me, the experience of death was more so a spiritual trauma than anything else. I had to work through all the other forms of trauma, and it eventually led to this kind of spiritual dimension, which is front and center with this idea of death and consciousness and life.
Right.
And there's a lot of different ways to kind of think about or understand spirituality and connect with it. So yeah, I don't know if that gets to...
Yes, it does. So then you sort of transitioned your life in another way, where you started speaking, you started doing public speaking. And when I started depicting the invisible, I wanted to give a voice to these veterans. I wanted to give a voice to these stories of trauma to affect positive change. And I think that that's the same thing that you are doing with your story. You are sharing your story to affect positive change. And I really like the story about you speaking to the West Point cadets and convincing them to give blood, because that's ultimately really what saved your life. And you know, I wonder if you can speak to that experience of publicly sharing your story to affect positive change.
So we realized the power that this story could potentially have. And I think really the power of stories that many people have can have an impact on what's happening in our world right now and the lives of other people. The first time I was asked to do that in a significant way was at West Point for a blood drive during kind of the height of the global war on terrorism. During the year of 9/11, they had record blood drives. coming out of the academy, which all the blood went straight to soldiers and service members overseas. And then just as normally happens, like kind of every year, it's sort of the donations dropped more and more and more and more to record lows. So they pulled me up just to speak to the Corps of Cadets for a few minutes, share my story and kind of just invite them to, you know, donate blood. And, you know, it spiked them back up to record levels that time. That was kind of what led to what would follow, which was a several year speaking circuit. The Department of Defense back then in roughly 2008 was launching a massive campaign for resilience, wellness. They were very aggressively trying to change and root out stigma associated with behavioral health. And I was kind of part of a smaller team that was a group of speakers that was going around the country, around the world, sharing these experiences with the intention of reducing or eliminating stigma associated with help-seeking behavior. I can say 15 years later, we've come a tremendously long way. The dynamics of what it looks like today does not look anything like what it looked back then. That doesn't mean that there's not still work to go, but it was kind of one of the positive effects of this story.
I'd like to share another portrait. You probably remember the portrait of Bird at the museum. He's a magnificent black man, very imposing, larger than life. His fists defiantly raised over his very impressive biceps as your eyes scan down from his direct eye contact down his body. You see he has a prosthetic leg. Its very shiny metal surface reflects on my studio lights. And his portrait is really a conundrum of powerful and vulnerable. And this is his story. Quote, "When you almost die three times, you just start living life to the fullest. I was 23. I was in Baghdad for 5 months. My Humvee hit a roadside bomb. I stood up to assess the situation, and my leg fell out of my pants. I told my wife before I left that I was going to lose my leg and that she was pregnant. She was, and I did. My PTSD is worse than the physical injury. Drugs they put me on made me more crazy than the PTSD. I smoke pot and come back, and everything is better. The first time I saw my wife after I was hurt, I was in a hospital bed. I was wondering if the love was still there. I'm grateful for my family every day." So Josh, in your book, you talk about a mother who lost her son to an IED. It severed his legs. And she talks about wrestling with the notion every night. Did he lose the will to live because he wouldn't be accepted by her or anyone else because of his missing limbs? What did you say to her that gave her peace?
I told her absolutely not. The only reason that I could say that with any kind of confidence is when I was on the operating table thrashing around near death, I used to say before I went to combat that I would rather die than lose a limb. Just kind of as a young, whatever I was, 24-year-old, that's just kind of what I believed because all this physical stuff was so important to me. I just couldn't fathom that. When I was actually in a position where even during the urgency of that situation, I didn't know what was wrong specifically, but I knew that it was bad and I knew that my leg might be taken. I had a sense of that. And I just remember thinking like, I couldn't have told that surgical team fast enough, take my leg, I'll figure out the rest later. Life is more worth it. And that's kind of the attitude that I really believe that her son would have had he had survived. And it sounds too like the portrait you just described as well, right? There are things that go so far beyond this physical and temporal world of ours. You know, sometimes we strike unfathomable adversity, but we also have an opportunity to make meaning out of those things and see the world through a different light.
Yes. What do you think it means to people who have experienced adversity to see works like Ken or Bird's portrait in a museum?
I think it can invite them to tell their own story. And that's ultimately what I encourage people to start to think about doing. I think it's valuable to have examples of people who either articulate their story verbally or articulate it in other forms of creative expression, whether that's the music or the arts or poetry or writing or whatever it may be, performing arts. It is this act of creativity that is literally the pathway through trauma. And that pathway is really a pathway of making meaning through these experiences.
So, you know, I want to bring you back to your speaking tour, and suicide rates were astronomical and the government had you on a national speaking tour with the objective of reducing stigma around getting help for PTSD. And you were speaking on this topic of trauma and PTSD around the country. And despite that, you say that you failed to recognize the symptoms in yourself.
Yeah. So in one sense, like I very much encourage people to learn how to tell their stories or express them, provided that there is a purpose behind it and provided that they're comfortable doing it. There can be dangers in articulating our stories too much, too often, and at a rate that we can't really grasp the meaning of what we're trying to say. I was doing hundreds of talks over the span of 2 years on top of a full-time job as an aide-de-camp and a company commander. And what that eventually turned into is the story, inadvertently and unintentionally, became a persona. It became a shield that I was hiding behind. I realize what I'm describing is kind of an extreme situation, but like telling that story over and over and over again, hundreds of times, pretty much in the same way, almost locked me into a certain version of it. And there was a point in time where I didn't realize this then, but there is so much more underneath the surface that was yet to be processed and discovered that I hadn't even started yet. Mm. So this idea of articulating or creativity or creative expression, right? Like, I'm sure that you understand this more than most. Creativity is a beautiful thing, but it's not always necessarily a fun thing. It can be a maddening thing. You know, and this goes all the way back to Plato, all the greatest blessings come by way of madness. Indeed, maddest that is heaven sent. And partially what he's talking about there is love and passion. And partially what he's talking about is this being, allowing ourselves to be occupied by this madness of creativity to try to articulate these stories in a way that creates resonance with another human being and ourselves. And when we can create that resonance, that's when we start dissolving the isolation that surrounds trauma. So, you know, wrapping all that up is again, just this emphasis that it is one way to look at this lifetime, right? Or a way to synthesize all these experiences is it's not about coming to a contained meaning or trying to follow somebody else. It's literally about coming to your own creation, right? And what story and what values are you going to carry forward?
Yeah. So, you know, you describe being on this path and then suddenly falling into a very deep suicidal spiral that seemed like out of the blue in a way, and that you felt that it was really fueled by guilt and shame. And you were alone in a hotel in DC and you were in a dark place. I wonder if you can like describe what happened.
Yeah. So that night was kind of the first night where everything started to collapse in a big way. There was several events leading up to it that I was kind of, again, I didn't know it at the time, but I was at effectively a breaking point. And there was a dissonance between what people thought I was on stage and the persona of what was, even though that was a very good thing in a lot of ways and it was helping the situation, I was disintegrating underneath. And one way to look at this is, I'll actually point to Carl Jung here, psychologist back in the early 1900s, who talked about the difference between the shadow self and the persona. So the persona is the idea of what we want the world to see of us. The shadow is what we don't even want ourselves to see about us. And part of, I think, what occurs when suicidal conditions happen is that we start to see that shadow come up.
Wow.
And so in those moments, right, I was crying. I lost it. I didn't want to live. I didn't know what was going on. And in that moment, I will say, you know, exactly what I've said over the years, right? Is that's where the power of human connection and relationships saved me and got me through those moments. Later on, years later, while that still holds, there was a point where this inward turn had to take place where I really went into solitude for almost 3 years and really just brought these shadow elements to the surface, brought the persona back down, and really came into a very difficult but realistic understanding of the self, right, and how to move forward.
You talk about how two friends talked you back from suicide in that hotel room in DC. And I know a lot of people who have actually been in that situation and they don't necessarily reach out for help. There's kind of a contradiction about the courage to be vulnerable. Can you speak to that and maybe, you know, give some insight to people who might be listening who are in a dark place that reaching out can be a really important step?
Yeah, you know, we are relational beings. We live in social networks. We need the presence of each other in order to move through life. And sometimes in our darkest moments, sometimes we have to place blind trust in people who can maybe see things about ourselves that we can't even see yet. It's these people that can kind of pull us back to life. And thinking about this kind of in a more radical way is just look at what happened during my experience of death. Like, I am absolutely convinced that if there was no medical intervention, I would have stayed dead. And at some point, my body would not have been able to turn back on. There were people, however, who are on this other side who are not giving up on me and who effectively proved that they can pull somebody back from the dead. You know, so maybe we're not talking a physical death here. Maybe we're talking a psychic death or a soul death, but there are other people in our lives that can pull us back to life.
That's beautifully said. You know, we have this stigma surrounding mental health or seeking help. And I think that in the military, you know, being macho and, you know, don't be the weak link, some of those stigmas maybe work against us when we should be asking for help.
Stigma. So I haven't been on this topic for close to 15 years now. I think there's actually in many ways a stigma around stigma. We tend to oversimplify what stigma is or can be. And I think the distinction is very important. There is, and you know, still is certainly to some degree, like a cultural stigma, and especially in some organizations, of where there's maybe a bravado mentality of, I'm tough, I'm going to push through. There's that kind of stigma. And I would say that we came a very long way over the last 15 years of changing military culture, become much more receptive to that. However, there's like also an internal stigma that can prevent people from getting help they need, that internal vulnerability that you discussed. Sometimes if I'm dealing with high levels of shame or guilt, maybe the reason that I'm not willing to seek help is because even subconsciously, I don't feel like I deserve it.
Mm.
Maybe some of the reasons that people don't seek help or don't talk about their experiences isn't necessarily because they don't want to talk about them. It's because they're having trouble trying to find the words to express them accurately and with the right level of acuity. These are very different experiences from the norm. And sometimes speaking about these things in ways that don't come out right can feel like it does more harm than good. There's a lot of different nuanced ways that we can have either an external stigma or an internal stigma. But how do we resolve it is kind of the next question, right? And part of that is humility. We are all vulnerable to the effects of psychological trauma. And everybody experiences trauma in one form or another. It does not discriminate. But when it comes to thinking that we can plow our way through it, you know, look at me as an example of that. I tried to plow my way through it for nearly a decade before it caught up with me. And there are a lot of things on the surface that look really good. And there were a lot of things that were good. There were also a lot of things that were not good. there were also a lot of ways that were losing my, that I was losing myself, and that I was projecting these forms of trauma in a different way on other people. One analogy we can think of is a prism. If we're looking at a mirror, right, the light can be reflected straight back. So if somebody punches me, I punch them straight back, right? That's a reflection. If it's a prism and the light is bent as it's coming through it, that's a refraction, right? It still comes into the prism, but then it leaves it in a slightly different way. Many times that's what happens with trauma, is we don't reflect it back on people. We can also refract it, which means it can come out on other people in a different way in our lives that we don't necessarily intend. And then there's another option that we can do. We can absorb it, right? And this is what a lot of people get in trouble with, myself included, is we just bury it, right? We carry it throughout our lives, and we hold that weight and that tension. And that too will eventually lead to our downfall. But then there's a fourth way, and that is we can integrate that. We can synthesize it. We can process it. We can take the true hero's journey of going within ourselves to understand and cultivate the meaning of these experiences so that we can lead to a better expression of ourselves in the world. Maybe this is just a good quote to tie this up. People in the military don't really like the word hero very much. And the only definition of heroism that I've really come to accept is by the mythologist Joseph Campbell in the early 1900s, who wrote a book called Hero with a Thousand Faces. And in there, he said, I'm paraphrasing, but he said that heroism is self-achieved submission. It is the willingness to take that inner plunge, that inner odyssey, that inner turn, to now have all these experiences in our background. Let's say for your audience, right, all these combat experiences and these profound experiences that we could spend the rest of our lives evaluating. There's a lot of potential intrinsic value in those experiences that can really lead to personal growth.
Yeah. So, I understand that you're currently pursuing a PhD and that your dissertation focuses on the role of philosophy in healing trauma. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I think there's a huge, pretty large gap in kind of mainstream psychology and what are called the cognitive behavioral sciences, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. And for all the progress that these modern therapeutic methods have made, and for all the value that they bring to the table, I think that they are incomplete when it comes to these deeper forms of trauma, such as grief and loss. Where I'm positioned at this point and what I'm working on is how can we leverage these ancient and modern even disciplines of philosophy to combine it with psychology in order to help people discover their values, virtues, and purpose in life. In other words, how do we help people tell their story to cultivate meaning and grow through adversity and trauma? And how can we incorporate this vast field of philosophy in order to understand maybe where these values that were broken by moral trauma and loss came from and how we can recapture them?
That sounds really fascinating. Good luck with that. How would you sum up what you've learned from your journey?
That the story is still being written. Creativity is the pathway through trauma. How we express that trauma is a reflection of our wisdom and our values. And that to always remember that story is still being written.
What would you like to say to some of the veterans that are out there who are still living in the aftermath of trauma?
I'd say that to think about it maybe like this way. People who have been through severe trauma have experienced something that most people in the world, most people certainly in our country, will not experience. To me, that makes those people exceptional, not defective. The reason that I say it is exceptional, even though it feels wretched and shameful at times, especially depending on where you're at in the process of growth and recovery, the reason that is exceptional is because you have experienced a form of life that occurs at such a high intensity and such a high complexity that it's given you a taste of reality in a way that most people aren't even going to be able to perceive. And in those high intensity experiences, I believe that they can reveal different truths about life that you may have access to that if you can find it, it can help cultivate a level of wisdom that can not only benefit yourself, your families, your social networks, but can also, frankly, benefit the world. I don't want to sound disconnected or too idealistic about that, but I truly believe it, that if you had the courage to set foot in combat, then trust me on this, if nothing else, that the real hero's journey has just begun. The hero's journey is also a Joseph Campbell thing, the mythologist I mentioned, that throughout history, right, there's these tendencies in myths, which is kind of how we shape our stories and our values and where many of our virtues originally come from. But the hero's journey is divided into three phases: the initiation, the separation, and the return. And the initiation is where the hero is basically trained up and goes through this grueling rite of passage, right? This maybe be like going through basic training, right? Mm-hmm. Getting ready for war. The separation is where the hero is separated from the tribe and goes off to war, perhaps, and experiences some great challenge that usually teaches them something profound about the world or themselves. And it's usually in some life-threatening way, very high-intensity way. And then the final phase, the return, is where that hero is supposed to come back and synthesize the wisdom and share it with the tribe. What I'm saying here is that we often get caught up on the initiation and the separation, i.e. basic training and the deployments, but we forget about the importance of the return and telling our story and coming to the meaning of those experiences. So the real hero's journey has just begun. That's that inner odyssey, right? Surround yourself with the right people who share those values, and also embrace that courage that is already within you to lean into these experiences and fight to find meaning in them.
That was really beautifully said, Josh. That was really beautiful. Thank you so much. Really, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for sharing your amazing story and your inspiration. My hope is that a lot of veterans who are out there who are suffering can hear your story and realize that even superheroes among us, even if you don't like the word, I can tell you that you're a superhero. You know, they can realize that superheroes among us even need help. And there's no shame in that. And I also just want to mention for you out there, if you want to hear more from Josh, I recommend his book, The Beauty of a Darker Soul, Overcoming Trauma Through the Power of Human Connection. So thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure, and so glad to get the chance to have a conversation with you on this.
Thank you. The pleasure's all mine. Take care.
You too.
That's all for today, folks. Thank you out there for tuning into the Depicting the Invisible podcast. This is Susan J. Baron, and I look forward to seeing you next time.